from PowerlineBlog.com. This is Powerline with John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierenkopf, and Stephen Hayward.
Welcome to another edition of the Powerline Show. There's just two of us today, Steve Hayward and me, John Hinderacher, and we are broadcasting again from my kitchen in Minnesota. Steve and I have spent the day driving around the countryside. That's a story in itself, but we won't tell it now. Instead, we are going to go straight to an interview. Steve, who's up today?
Well, I had the good fortune a few weeks ago to run into Michael Walsh, a well-known writer. He's often on Breitbart and other places, longtime journalist for, I think, Newsweek magazine years ago. And he has a terrific book out called The Devil's Pleasure Palace. And I told him I thought that sounded like a porno movie from the 70s. He said, no, that's from Schubert. And the problem is, I don't know Schubert from Sherbert. So I'll let Michael explain what the book's about. It's about some of the origins of radical leftist thought in America and why it's become so influential in popular culture. And so here's me and Michael from 2 weeks ago in Los Angeles. So I'm joined now by Michael Walsh, the author of The Devil's Pleasure Palace, The Cult of Critical Theory and the Subversion of the West. And Michael, I think I'll start with this question, and it's about the Frankfurt School, the subject of your book. And I think a lot of lay listeners would think The Devil's Pleasure Palace sounds like a porno movie from the 70s, right? The Frankfurt School does Dallas or something. And the Frankfurt School is probably an art colony or something. So why don't we start by giving a little overview of what the Frankfurt School is and why you think it is so important for us to understand.
Wow. Thank you, Steve. I'm such a square. I always thought that Devil's Pleasure Palace referred to Schubert, but I suppose it could refer to the devil in Miss Jones in the Pleasure Palace. So if we go back to the early 70s. As far as the Frankfurt School is concerned, they were a group of philosophers, mostly Germans, who were assembled at the Goethe University in Frankfurt. And there they developed a notion called critical theory. They founded something called the Institute for Social Research. It gave it a very anodyne name so that people wouldn't see what they were sneakily up to, which is basically the destruction of Western civilization as we know it and as they knew it. Because largely they were Jewish, they fell under the onus of Hitler, of course, and they escaped to Switzerland, and then they came to the United States, where they found a home in Columbia University. So from Columbia, they spread out through the United States via academe, both literally and figuratively. Some of them went home after the war, but others, like Herbert Marcuse, stayed and eventually wound up at the University of California, San Diego. And he was certainly a prominent philosopher when you and I were in college, and there was really no escaping the Marcusean philosophy. But essentially it boils down to this. Critical theory is let's challenge and attack and, if possible, destroy every single tenet of Western civilization just for the sake of doing it. So I've often compared them to the Gordon Gekko character in Wall Street. When he's asked, why do you want to wreck this company, he says, because it's wreckable, okay? And that's really all there is to it. It sounds like it should be some deep think German thing, but it's really not. It's kind of a juvenile revolt, and you're mad at your dad because he wouldn't let you have the car the night before.
Well, isn't part of what's going on here an attempt to rescue Marxism from its economic failure, right? I mean, it was evident by the beginning of World War II that the orthodox Marxism that was materialist economic determinism had failed. The working class didn't rally to the international proletariat. And so now you substitute, what, culture for economics. Isn't that sort of the intellectual part of it?
Yes, that's correct. The origin of the Frankfurt School really lies in World War I, which was essentially the destruction of Western civilization. So two men in particular, Antonio Gramsci, an Italian, and Georg Lukács, a Hungarian, as a revolt against the senseless destruction of World War I, began to feel like Western civilization was now a kind of evil that needed to be put out of its misery. And Lukács lasted forever. He survived the 30s. He survived Hitler. He survived well into the Hungarian parliament in the 50s. He's quite an important figure, especially in Central Europe. So the two of them created this notion of critical theory, essentially, and then passed it along to the actual members proper of the Frankfurt School. But they felt that, yes, economic Marxism had clearly failed, that the proletariat didn't rise up, so that the way to to get Marxism wasn't from the ground up, which is what Marx had thought, but imposed from an intellectual level on down. And the way to do that, of course, was through the universities.
Is there are there ways that this differs or builds upon just straightforward German nihilism of Nietzsche and Heidegger? Is it distinct from those? Or maybe another way of asking that question or a follow-up is, did we actually need the Frankfurt School? Weren't many of these destructive tendencies already there in the general direction of German thought?
Yeah, definitely. Clearly, Marxism comes out of Hegelianism and the notion of the synthesis, which I think was actually a very damaging idea because, as I like to say about Devil's Pleasure Palace, I try to give Manichaeanism a good name again, which is that there's good and there's evil, and there is no and cannot be any synthesis between good and evil. So you have Nietzsche, Beyond Good and Evil, another advocate of this notion that there's something else besides darkness and light, God and Satan, Hegelianism, and you're right, I write up through Heideggerianism, which, and he, of course, was a philosopher of the Nazi Party, or certainly joined the Nazi Party. So this, you know, again, we could go into this whole notion where the Nazis right wing, the answer obviously is no, what part of National Socialist German Workers' Party sounds like the Reagan Revolution. But I do think there was that certainly in the bloodstream, and they just took it to a new and destructive level.
Talk a bit about the importance of what I call, what I've written in my notes of your book, separatism or separation, or this idea that what you want to do as part of the broader political project is to just separate people from each other as much as possible. I mean, this is part of what radical feminism is about and the way the civil rights movement has degraded, I think. Talk a little bit about that for a moment.
Yeah, that's an interesting approach to how to destroy a society. Deconstructionism is very clearly part of this intellectual movement. And when you start to take everything apart, you know, when you're, as a writer, you look at words on the page like cat and you go, is that spelled right? I mean, wait a minute. Is that a K or should there be an E with a circumflex over? I mean, you begin to doubt the evidence of your own senses. And so what they did with that, a particular approach was to segment the audience, the populace, the electorate, into little tiny balkanized pieces so that the whole was now fully questionable on a multiplicity of fronts. And they were very, very effective at doing it. One of the points I make in Devil's Pleasure Palace is they went after the family right off the bat because they knew if you can attack the structure at its most fundamental, if you can bust up the building stone, then you really have a chance to bring the house down. So I compare them to Samson and the temple, but without any real reason for pulling the temple down. At least Samson did have a reason. And now we're watching these things collapse, and they're collapsing, I think, at a speed that we would never have guessed possible. The Obergefell decision moved gay marriage from a gleam in Andrew Sullivan's eye to the law of the land. Assuming, by the way, that you assume that what the Supreme Court rules is the law of the land. I had a very spirited debate about this recently with a group of guys in Washington, and I still want somebody to tell me how that is the law of the land constitutionally. I know, yes, people raise Marbury versus Madison, but it seemed to me Congress is the one that makes laws of the land, not the Supreme Court.
Yeah, to follow up on that, I mean, it's one thing to have interest group liberalism of the New Deal era, but now I think to rephrase what you just said, I think is we have interest group liberalism on steroids, and it's not really liberal anymore, of course.
No.
There's one sentence from page 107 that jumps out at me. Once safely in the United States, the Frankfurt School sappers had one philosophical objective, to remove the moral high ground of the American way and replace it with self-doubt.
Yeah, I think, one of the things about this book is we've started by saying it's about the Frankfurt School, but it's really not about the Frankfurt School. It's more about God and Satan and good and evil. And when I started this book, I was talking with Roger Kimball, who's the publisher of Encounter. And we were talking about, let's do a book. And he said, what book do you want to do? I said, I want to do a book about God and Satan and good and evil and classical music and poetry. And if that's not commercial enough, Roger said, wait a minute, what's the public policy angle? So I said, the Frankfurt School, that we would use them as a symbol of this, again, Manichaeanism, perhaps too strong a word, but perhaps not, but the yin and yang of our society, and that they were definitely on the side of Satan. So, which is why I use Paradise Lost and Faust as the two poems that I use as deconstruction elements, in a way, of the deconstructionists. It's kind of fun.
Right. I want to talk a bit about the importance of narrative in a moment, but to follow up a little bit on some of these people and their thought, you know, I used to think the kind of jargon you read, especially of the more recent figures like Zizek and Badu or whoever you say his name, who may or may not be Frankfurters, it's hard to tell. They're so unintelligible.
Yeah.
And for a long time, I thought, who could possibly be taken in by the unintelligibility of this turgid, jargon-laden prose? But then it occurred to me just recently, literally the last few weeks as I've been suffering through more of this, that what's going on here perhaps is, if you believe in nothing, essentially,
yeah,
and your object actually is to tear down things, then you thrill to jargon that obscures things.
Yes.
Is that a plausible theory?
Oh, I think so. I use the phrase, they throw up these great quantities of squid ink. And a good example of this, when I was at the Eastman School of Music as an undergraduate in Rochester, we all had to read some of Adorno, and I started thinking about a critic's career for me about the time I was a junior at Eastman. And I started taking German, and I moved pretty quickly to accomplishment in the language. So I started reading Adorno. And as a music critic now, especially going back to Adorno, you realize he's terrible. He doesn't have the slightest idea what is really going on in the areas of classical music that I understand as a critic, and other people do. And then you understand the whole thing is just basically a lie. It's like the guy who's pulled an all-nighter to BS his way through his senior exam and hopeful that if he emits enough verbiage, the teacher will at least give him a C for effort and he can move on.
One of your phrases that you use in the book, here it's page 71, you describe critical theory as, here's the quote, a miasmic gas that chokes the life out of free-ranging rational discourse. I mean, part of what's going on here is to delegitimize rational discourse, right? I mean,
yeah,
that's one of the definitions of ideology, is an idea system without any rational foundation.
Well, that's where political correctness comes from, of course, is by taking words away from us or from anyone. You render them defenseless against your attack. So I'll give an example that just happened. A couple weeks ago, I was in New York at the UN Conference on Women, and we were doing a breakout panel and with a group of what turned out to be social justice warriors. It was a largely female group in attendance. We had a packed house. And then after listening to me for 15 minutes, one of the girls stood up. Oh, excuse me, woman with a Y stood up and said, I think you're a racist, homophobic, bigoted, you know, just exactly what you would have expected her to say. But rather than sit there and take it, because I am Irish after all, I said, wait a minute, you don't even know me, and you've just insulted me. Why did you do that? So you have to turn the tables on them. And once you get them out of their jargon, because, you know, like those wonderful words, can't and jargon, this is how they speak, and they assume, as thieves can't does, that everyone understands the terminology. But you reject the terminology, and they're disarmed. And you know what happened after that? Tears.
There was no safe space in the breakout room. Was that right?
I wanted to say, there's no crying in baseball. There's no crying in baseball.
Your wonderful sentence you have on this point, page 157, is the key to understanding political correctness is its constant redefinition of what is acceptable regarding the use of language. It's Sisyphus on the euphemism treadmill. That's a wonderful phrase, Michael, by the way.
You know, I forgot I wrote that phrase, so yeah, I'll take credit for it, but thank you. Yeah, it is Sisyphus on the treadmill. I mean, they're going to wear you down. That's what they're going to do, and it's going to make your life impossible. And you just want to say, I want to get off this bus. Can we stop this argument? Is everybody nutty here? Where are we going with this? And the answer is nowhere. And that's the hardest part for people to accept, is that the nihilism of it ends in nothing and there's no replacement. You think, let's say Bernie Sanders, for example, he's promising these young kids the moon, you know, and this guy is a bona fide nut. He's never had a job in his life. He's that professor you had back in the 60s, you know, that you smoked dope with, you know, after class. And now he's running for president. And the young people go, yeah, that sounds awesome. But where is it? It's going to end in disaster. Now, just the other day, I was in Washington talking to the Institute of World Politics about my time behind the Iron Curtain, starting in February of 85 when I went to East Germany for the 40th anniversary of the Dresden bombing. So I listened to a speech by Erich Honecker, to my trip to Russia with Vladimir Horowitz, the pianist, in 86, where Chernobyl blew up. Then I was at Berlin in 1989 when the wall came down, and then I went to, I'm like Zelig, and then I went to Moscow, and unfortunately I blew it. I left 2 weeks before the coup against Gorbachev. So I got to watch what the practical result of what Sanders wants to do, and it's terrible. It's I recommend to, if people are listening and you want to hear those remarks, they're up at the Institute of World Politics website and easily accessible.
Yeah, I'm going to link that, I think. Having just said that an awful lot of this critical theory is conducted in a jargon and an inaccessible language except for insiders, and even they, I think, can't make any sense out of it. On the other hand, you emphasize, I think rightly, the importance of narrative. Mm. The left tells a story. And maybe here we should conduct some self-criticism of conservatives, because to their narrative, I think we are too often offering narrowness. In other words, what do we hear from our political leaders and some of our intellectual leaders? We need more tax cuts. We need to emphasize the principles of limited government.
Yeah. Oh, that's a sexy selling point, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. I mean, I think that there's no wonder that Donald Trump has struck a chord, because
absolutely.
He doesn't do that, right? And so say a little bit about the importance and role of narrative. And if you want to go on from there and talk about how conservatives have failed to contest the left on that ground, that is so important.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for that, because this is my new obsession. And I didn't really realize it was my obsession until after I'd written this book. And then I started talking about it at think tanks in Washington. By narrative, obviously, I mean a story that has a beginning, middle, and an end. It follows the strictures of Aristotle's Poetics. Every Hollywood screenplay, and I work in Hollywood now, conforms to this. When you write a novel, it conforms to it. When you write anything, pretty much, it conforms to it. We have on our side the heroic narrative. That is, and I use the Christ story literarily, not theologically, to illustrate this, as did Jack Miles in his book, Christ, A Crisis in the Life of God. So this boy is born, and suddenly he finds himself teaching in the temple, and he becomes a phenomenon. He rises to the occasion. He has a three-year itinerant ministry in which he changes the lives of many people. The bad guys get him. It looks bad for our hero, and in fact, they actually kill him. And then the ultimate triumph is he resurrects and moves on. And not only is that the underpinning of Christianity, but it's the basic story of every heroic myth from time immemorial. I live in Ireland a good deal of the year now, and I'm very interested in Irish myths. So for Cú Chulainn, for example, is a very similar character to Christ. And I think every culture has that. Now, the left's narrative is that the funny thing about their narrative is that we're the bad guys. That's their narrative. They don't really position themselves as good guys because they can never deliver on what they want to do. But they force us into this narrow legalistic way of dealing with them, which is silly. And my advocacy now, and I'm actually hoping to start some kind of a think tank in Washington that would just be for the artistic side of politics. That would be the cultural, Western cultural underpinnings of politics, because we're now arguing on the margins. Every time I hear Paul Ryan talk, I weep, because he never, ever gets to the point of what the real problem is. So if you go out and offer tax cuts, well, how many people pay income taxes? Not that many, relatively. Half the population doesn't even pay them. So how do they hear that? You're going to take away my welfare benefits. That's why they keep losing. And we're burking conservatives in favor of limited government. I hear this from National Review, my friends there, all the time. That's not going to sell. And if you confuse that with conservatism, you're going to keep losing. And I think a big problem that I have now at my ancient age of 66 is a lot of the younger guys, the big famous guys, were born in the late 60s and early 70s. They didn't earn conservatism. They grew up in the Reagan Revolution. And, you know, you always think that normality is what happened when you were a kid or a young man. They weren't there for Goldwater, and they certainly weren't there for the year 1968, which, as you recall, was a nightmare. And that's how we eventually got to Reagan, but it wasn't a pretty sight. And we need to be conscious of that, and we need to understand, how did we get here? And so I'm very hot now on trying to bring together some of the best people in the country to talk about these issues in a non-lawyerly, cultural way. We've lost that, and I think it's a big mistake.
In addition to recapturing narrative and culture, what are some of the other remedies that we should have on our mind
And I mean, one of them is you quote Martin Luther saying the best thing you can do to the devil, or worst thing you can do to the devil, is to laugh at him, right?
Yes. Yeah, that goes throughout history. The devil, that proud spirit, cannot bear to be mocked. Sir Thomas More said that. They're ridiculous people, let's face it. I mean, come on, none of them can change a tire, for God's sake. And yet they're so full of rage. And when I started this book, the first sentence I wrote was, rage is a characteristic of Satan. And rage is the characteristic emotion of the left. That Satan wants corpses, God wants souls. Satan is infuriated by his loss in paradise, which he can never, ever get back, but can hurt God through us. Again, not theologically. This is very clear from Paradise Lost, from Milton, which I think is one of the great foundations of Western civilization. And I urge everyone to read it, even though backwards ran the sentences until reeled the mind. Once you get used to that, you'll find a very wonderful and moving poetic experience. But that's it. They're angry, and it's almost an inchoate sort of anger that we are surprised by, because we tend not to be angry people. And when we do get angry, it's because we've been punched and prodded and poked and smacked around. And then as soon as we react, we're called, you know, full of rage and hateful.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, we react to injustice. And at the end of the day, or actually the beginning of the day, this is a fundamentally unjust creed on the left, whether it's the Frankfurt versions or other kinds of nihilism that deny you can have a rational basis for justice. And so, yeah, that's right. You get angry when that becomes explicit. That's, they try to disguise us, of course, by claiming to be in favor of justice, right? And that's where that confusion is deliberate, I think, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, as Mary McCarthy said of Lillian Hellman, every word out of her mouth is a lie, including the and but, or, you know, whatever she said. But that's the truth, is I don't believe anything they say. I just literally don't believe it. Global warming, I don't believe it, you know? Social justice, I don't believe it. If justice has to have a modifier, it's not justice. If science has to have a modifier, like social science, it's not science. They are just, again, they're squid ink masters. And you can sit there and think about it for a minute and think, that sounds reasonable. But then you realize it's complete crap. Andrew Clavin told a wonderful anecdote once when we were on a National Review cruise. And it was, he was talking to some guy about, does he believe everything he reads in the newspapers? And the guy said, nah, you know, I've had too much experience with it. And he said, well, you know, sometimes I read a story in the paper, says there was a plane crash, and I say to myself, maybe.
Let me give you an exit question.
Andrew tells it better than I do, but that's the gist of the joke.
Well, you need a bigger audience. I'm a poor audience for that. I'll do a big exit question here. At the very end of your book, which I didn't get to read with the full care it deserves, but I thought you were making out an argument that ultimately sort of the doctrines of critical theory and the nihilist left are self-defeating. And part of it seemed to suggest that a lot of them sell out, you know, they lack materialism. And the other one is that they just suffer from intellectual exhaustion. I say I didn't quite master it, so I wonder if you could sort of restate your conclusion for us.
Yeah. Based on my experience in the Soviet Union, for example, when I went there in 86, and earlier in East Germany, but East Germany was actually, if you remember, the communist country that worked, there was like more than one thing on the shelf in the store. So that was their definition of working. The disparity was between the preached doctrine and the life on the street. So that when you went, say, under Red Square to cross, to go have a look at the wax dummy museum, Lenin's tomb, yeah, that one, you would immediately, and this is 1986, literally outside the walls of the Kremlin, be assaulted, not physically, but be approached by people willing to sell you anything. The girls would sell you their bodies. The men would sell you caviar or some other contraband that they had stolen out of some restaurant. They would offer to buy your jeans right off your lower extremities. It was a vast black market of a country that had been defeated ideologically and didn't know it was dead yet. So I actually came back to the States and I wrote a book proposal about the coming end of communism and how I thought Germany would be reunited within 3 years, and it was turned down by every publisher because I was really way wrong on Germany. No, Germany, I said Germany's going to be reunited in 5 years. It was reunited in 3, so I was way wrong on that, and the publishers were right. But they can't keep it up because there's too much pull between what they think is true and what their own senses tell them is a lie. And most of them aren't bad people. They're just trying to make this thing mesh, and it will not mesh. It just doesn't work. And yet every generation, I guess, has to learn this over and over again. So what I say at the end of the book is this. Our salvation is already written in our hearts. That is the Western heroic narrative that antedates religion. Again, the Christ story non-theologically is exactly the same as a bunch of stories that come in folk culture before it, and that's why it worked, because even the pagan Irish could understand this story. And we need to get back to that understanding that we are, yes, God's children, we are heroes of our own life. We're not cogs in a machine. We're not hamsters in a cage. This is what they want us to be, human batteries in the Matrix, if you remember that movie. That's the perfect – that's why all these movies, whether they're written by leftists or not, they never even think of this. They're articulating a conservative vision. High Noon is a very good example, written by a card-carrying communist, Carl Foreman, and maybe the most conservative, individualistic, okay, I've been abandoned by everybody except one good woman, but I'm going to get these guys, even if it kills me. That's our story. How can that not sell? Oh, no. Tax cuts. Yeah, that'll do it. We need men of vision. We actually need educated men, which we don't have as politicians. And then we need men of vision who are willing to tell the left to stuff it, and that to articulate the vision that we, you got to dance with what brung you. This is what brung us. Heroic narrative, Enlightenment civilization, and the rule of law, not as corrupted by the current administration and its Justice Department, but actual law that treats everyone equally. And by equally, we actually mean equal, not some are more equal than others. We're in an Orwellian world now. It's time to take it back.
Right. Well said, Michael. Michael Walsh, thank you very much, and good luck with the book and your next project.
Hey, thank you, Steve.
Speaking of radicals, how about that Obama administration?
Well, yeah, I mean, interesting news story out here late today as we're taping about the federal district judge who has ruled in favor of the House of Representatives in their lawsuit challenging the way the Obama administration diverted funds from other places to pay for some parts of Obamacare that Congress refused to fund. I mean, it really is a case of the executive usurping the power of the purse. And there was a lot of doubt for a while whether the House would first have standing to bring the lawsuit, and then second, whether they would succeed on the merits. But they've now succeeded in both of those. And so we're now setting up another appellate court clash about Obamacare. It wouldn't bring down the law the way the other two lawsuits would have. But I think, John, you're reading some of the opinion. What is at issue is the subsidies for health insurance providers in certain cases. And Congress refused to appropriate any money for these subsidies. And the Obama administration just said, we don't care. We'll just take some money from somewhere else.
Yeah, you know, of all of the baleful legacies of the Obama administration, I think the worst is its lawlessness. Repeatedly, the administration has just thumbed its nose at federal law, at the Constitution, and has proceeded by executive fiat. And having now read the opinion by Judge Rosemary Collier of Washington, D.C., I think she writes very persuasively, and it seems... it seems clear that this is an instance of exactly that, where the Obama administration has simply ignored the law and said, well, even though Congress would not appropriate money for these subsidies to insurance companies, the law really won't work without those subsidies, you know, and therefore the rates would go way too high, and therefore we're gonna dredge money up from somewhere and pay them. And, you know, she goes through all the legal arguments. She goes one by one through all of the textual justifications that the administration offers, all of which seem to me to be shockingly weak. I don't think there's any question about the fact that the law is written so that Congress is required or is expected to fund these subsidies annually if they are to be funded. And if Congress doesn't fund them, they don't exist. So I think her opinion is very well founded, and we're destined now for the D.C. Court of Appeals, which of course is stacked by Democrats. One thing though, Steve, I want to pause on. You know, in a sense, almost even more important than the merits of the case is the standing issue. Now, here's an instance where Congress passed a statute. Part of it, one provision of that statute requires annual funding by Congress if it is to take place. Congress decided not to fund it, didn't fund it, and the administration said, "Well, we don't care, Congress. We're gonna take the money from someplace else and spend it this way anyway, even though you didn't appropriate the money." Now, if the House of Representatives doesn't have standing to challenge that, I think, patently illegal action by the Obama administration, well, then who does?
Well, that's a good question. Although, you know, you're the lawyer and I'm not, and some of the thresholds for standing have always baffled me as a layperson.
They baffled me as a law student, too.
Okay. Well, then it's not just my problem. I did talk to a House insider many months ago who was worried that they might have made a blunder in the following sense. They appropriated zero in the budget, and they thought, well, we should have done, perhaps, to enhance our standing and also to make a broader point, is to have appropriated a token amount, a very small amount. He thought $1, but you might have done, say, $1 million, an amount plainly below what the Obama administration wanted to spend. Then it would have been more clearly a case of completely violating what Congress had budgeted for a specific purpose. And so that's an interesting legal argument to leave to one side. It looks like they're going to win anyway. I'm hoping this is a sign that Congress is slowly beginning to reacquire its ability to control the executive branch through the budget. They haven't shown much facility with that, and that's a long and tangled and often unfortunate story. I'll add one other thought about this. The Obama Justice Department has been, as we know, badly politicized, first under Eric Holder and now under Loretta Lynch. But they've also corrupted the Office of Legal Counsel. Those are, you know, mostly professional lawyers of the Justice Department, often with a, you know, political appointee or a what's so-called Schedule C appointee. You know, that was our friend John Yoo for a while under George Bush. But they also try to provide serious legal analysis and have institutional memory of the way the Justice Department thinks about things over the very long term. And the Obama Justice Department, the Attorney General and the Solicitor General, have simply ignored the Office of Legal Counsel numerous times. And in a few cases, I think of the Sackett case, Sackett versus EPA, and a few others a few years ago, where the Obama administration lost at the Supreme Court by a 9-0 vote, meaning they didn't even get any of the liberal justices, you could really tell if you read closely in the oral arguments that even the liberal judges are saying, you can't really be coming into court with that bad an argument, can you? But in fact, they have been, and that really shows the supremacy of politics over precedent and any fair reading of the law that this administration has decided to embrace.
Yeah, it's really sad. I think the lawlessness of the Obama administration is probably the worst of its many awful traits. Well, this case is called House of Representatives versus Burwell. It is obviously destined for appeal to the D.C. Circuit, and Josh Earnest has already proclaimed his confidence that the administration will prevail there, which I would say, given the way that court has been stacked with Democrats and given Democrats' proclivity to vote as a bloc in cases which they perceive as political, that prediction might very well turn out to be true, even though, as I said, I think Judge Collier's reasoning is very difficult to argue with. But I assume that means then the case is destined for the Supreme Court, and by the time it gets there, we'll no longer have a 4-4 Supreme Court, presumably. Presumably, whoever takes office in January of 2017 will have appointed that ninth justice. And I guess this is just one more reminder of what an important election we have coming up.
I think there's one other reminder today to switch topics a little bit. We've talked about what the campaign's going to be like between, we think at least, it looks like it's Trump versus Hillary. Strange things may yet happen on either side. But there's another story out here that the Wall Street Journal has broken about another episode of what appears to be Clinton Foundation corruption, funneling donations, charitable donations to a company run by friends of theirs. And somebody I saw asked this question. I wish I remember now, and it didn't dawn on me till I saw this story how important it is. What's the Clinton Foundation going to be like if Hillary is elected president? I mean, are they going to carry on raising money from lots of rich people all around the world? Apparently $100 million from interests in the Middle East and the Arabian countries. You really think Bill Clinton is going to cease all his do-gooding work and not continue to traffic that way? It seems to me that the media, at least, and certainly Trump, I expect is clever enough to do this, is going to raise this question in the course of the campaign, and certainly ought to raise this question in the course of the campaign. Here you have prospective corruption on a massive scale, and it will be interesting to see whether the media follows up on it and how Madam Hillary answers the subject.
Well, I suspect, Steve, that the Clintons will avoid any possibility of conflict of interest by appointing Chelsea to take over the Clinton Foundation.
Well, why not? She's already apparently commanding $65,000 for speaking appearances at the age of 35 or whatever. Although, by the way, you noticed that her husband's hedge fund recently shut down because maybe it's a metaphor for the Democratic Party. Her husband had a hedge fund that was betting heavily on the revival of the Greek economy. Maybe he'll start a new hedge fund to bet on the revival of the Venezuelan economy or the Brazilian impeachment or some other fanciful thing. It's just sort of amazing that we're still stuck with these kinds of stories and that after all these years, we're still talking about the crazy Clintons.
Well, Steve, call me an optimist, but I firmly believe that Donald Trump is going to beat Hillary Clinton in the fall and that this will be the final, long-awaited final chapter in the Clinton drama.
Well, you know, among other things to be said about Trump is it does suggest that it took a Trump. If that turns out to be true, John, it will show that it took a Trump to finally end the rule of the Clintons, something that the rest of the Republican Party proved to be unable to do for such a long time.
Well, let's hope that's the way it turns out, Steve. Well, that's probably enough for today. Let's put this one in the can, and we will be back soon with another edition of the Powerline Show.
Powerline is a production of PowerlineBlog.com. John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierendorf, Stephen Hayward, Joseph Malchow, and produced by Madison McQueen in association with Ricochet.com.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.